Starring today in this edition of The Mincing Rascals, you'll hear about Michael Flynn, J.B. Pritzker, President Trump, a wayward nurse, I mean that in a most respectful way, and then some predictions about when we get back to baseball and school. This is John Williams, and thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. We hope you share it with your friends, and please do email your questions, comments, criticisms, and observations, and praise, by the way, we're cool with praise as well, to johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. Email me, johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. And if you've got knee pain, here's the sponsor part. Go to the Joint Relief Institute, please. Even if you don't have joint pain, I think you could go there. They could use the business, and we sure appreciate their sponsoring the Mincing Rascals podcast. They're open. They're an essential business. If you've got knee pain, you know how essential getting that fixed is. So don't put it off, especially if you've got a little time right now. Remember that your insurance almost surely pays for it, and the first visit is free. They've got two locations in Orland Park and Oak Brook. It's the same phone number for either spot. Online, visit jointreliefinstitute.com. Or call them, 708-888-0000. We think it's kind of clever. We say 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Okay, we go Bertrand, Heather, Austin, Eric. You guys ready? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Today is Thursday, May 7th, 2020. It's 1:38 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams, and we are the Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record over Zoom and from the studios of WGN Radio and elsewhere.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio newsroom.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President. Oh my God, I wasn't listening to the instructions.
I'm Heather Chiron from WTTW.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the obedient columnist from the Tribune who listens to the instructions and waits for his turn.
I feel like a homeschooler. I told you kids how to behave. In fact, I have the on my syllabus. I thought we'd start out with phase two that we're in the state of Illinois. But you guys want to just jump on the somewhat breaking news here that they're dropping the charges against Michael Flynn?
Well, it's a pretty remarkable thing. I mean, Flynn had pleaded guilty. And they were awaiting sentencing. He wanted to withdraw his guilty plea. The Justice Department re-looked into it, and they announced today, AP got the documents, court filings, I guess, saying that they're going to abandon the case altogether. Now, earlier today, Axios reported that the lead prosecutor in the case was withdrawing. So I will probably find out that that was in protest. But, you know, this has been a rallying cry for President Trump that Michael Flynn was treated unfairly, and he had his Justice Department look at it again. And now Flynn, who was a cooperator with the Mueller report, will walk free after a guilty plea.
Michael Flynn did not fully cooperate with the Mueller investigation. The special counsel could never get to the bottom of whether it was the president who directed Michael Flynn to tell the Russian ambassador, hey, don't retaliate because Obama is going to impose sanctions in retaliations for interfering in the 2016 presidential election. And Flynn would never say one way or the other. It's also yet to be seen whether or not the Justice Department, perhaps under a future president, would bring charges against Michael Flynn, because there's a significant amount of evidence that he was also working for Turkey at the time that he was also serving as President Trump's first national security advisor.
I thought the MO was kind of, who cares, we'll just pardon him when we're done. Was that not an option for the president here?
It was an option. I think that this is the best possible result for Trump, because he gets to crow about how Flynn was mistreated and he didn't have to intervene himself. Flynn pled guilty and the judge asked him, you know, you did this, right? You knew it was wrong, correct? And Flynn said, yes, he did. He knew it was wrong. He lied to the FBI. He knew that was wrong. You know, and this idea that we entrapped a three-star general into lying to the FBI and he didn't know it was wrong. I have never bought that story. I don't understand how the right-wing media got all spun up about it, but it clearly worked. It's the Justice Department under Bill Barr who has let Flynn go, I guess. Just one more strange and outrageous thing, I guess.
Was it not a mistake for the FBI official to say, what's our goal, to get him to lie?
I think that there's a certain amount of, we don't really know what the full conversation was in that, because part of those notes were redacted. But also, every police officer in every jurisdiction in every town knows and asks questions that they know the answer to in an attempt to get people to lie. And, you know, I've covered Illinois politics long enough to know that the cardinal rule is don't lie to the G, right?
That was the one thing that Blagojevich got convicted of the first time around. Was lying to the feds. And the idea that, I mean, they were calling it a perjury trap. I don't exactly know how that term would apply to what happened with Flynn. You know, they were asking him questions, thinking that he was going to lie, and he lied. Is that a trap? I don't know. If you're an honest public official, it's not a trap.
So the president gets the Justice Department to do his bidding so he doesn't get his hands dirty with a pardon later, right? Is that what we're thinking here?
Yeah, although given the way this story was going, it didn't look like he was going to have to pay much of a price. I mean, at this point, what could Trump possibly do that would shake those people who are going to vote for him not to vote for him? It just doesn't seem, nothing he does seems very risky to me.
What's the name of the new White House press secretary?
Haley McEnany.
Did you guys watch her first press briefing, the first one that White House had in 417 some odd days, something like that?
And with that, I'll take questions.
Kelly, if I could, welcome to the podium for the first time.
Thank you.
As well.
She promised not to lie to the press.
I will never lie to you. You have my word on that.
And then proceeded to lie shamelessly to the press.
That's a really bold statement. That's like, you know, you get drafted out of college to play basketball and you're like, I'm going to be the next Michael Jordan. You know, I'm going to score 50 points a game. Like, you're the press secretary for the White House. You're saying you're not going to lie.
Well, are you not supposed to say that?
No, it's be a press secretary and say something that kind of sounds like that, but it's not actually that.
No,
that's what press secretaries do.
Asking her that was a perjury trap because there's no way, no way you can answer that question honestly.
You know, it's the sort of statement that should not be said because it should go without saying. But the quote that you, the thing that you dropped in there, Austin, where you said, was it wrong for the FBI to say, let's get him to lie? She said, quote unquote, here's what that transcript shows.
We have a handwritten FBI note that says, quote, we need to get Flynn to lie, quote, and get him fired.
She didn't have the quote right. As bad as it looks for the FBI, it's not as bad as the administration is selling it.
I fully recognize I probably am letting my bias against prosecutors and the criminal justice system generally in cases like this to get in the way. But I do think it was an unforced error. And I do think people should treat investigations, not just this one, but anything being pursued by the FBI with anything, with any political taint, either way, with a high level of skepticism.
Whence this distrust of the Justice Department, Austin?
You should be extraordinarily distrustful of the Justice Department as well. And of course, they have political motivations. But to say that the FBI didn't, but the Justice part does, I think is kind of belies decades of American history and how they behave.
Son, go to the state of Illinois. Here's what I wrote. Set your phasers to 2. The governor has a 5-point plan to get Illinois out of the COVID pandemic. And for us to get to phase 3, the number of patients being admitted to hospitals and the numbers needing ICU beds has to become stable or decline. And we will need to have contact tracing in place. We'll need to monitor the people that have come into contact with the people that have COVID-19. And only then can manufacturing offices, retail, barbershops, salons reopen with some limitation. And we'd still need face coverings. And that's phase 3. To get to phase 4, I think that's the big one. Bars and restaurants and schools open. We have to have a continued decline in the admissions in hospitals. And we have to have more contact tracing in place. And then you only get to have 50 people in one place. And boy, that to me seems a light year away. What do y'all think of the governor's 5-phase plan? We asked about it as a news click, just a type in web poll question, non-scientific. But still, 1 in 5 people who responded to it said they just hate it. Austin, you go first.
Why do I have to go first? No, it's okay.
Because you're the one who predicted this whole thing. When we were poo-pooing it, you said it was going to be this bad.
I have a lot of issues with this plan. I don't even, you can call it a plan. I think the audience for it was to satiate members of the media and other people who were calling for a plan and not necessarily to actually give certainty to people on the ground that need more of it. The most frustrating thing about it, I would say, maybe isn't even one particular aspect of it, but the fact that he waited longer than any big state governor to release anything you could call a reopening plan and yet it still lacks these basic details. You cannot tell me that an average person can keep score at home with that document that was released. You can't. Readability is bad. Its details are bad. There's no dates whatsoever, even example dates that would help people understand when they might be, you know, start to spend money on rearranging their hair salon or, you know, their nail salon or something like that. I don't think it's a helpful document or plan for the vast majority of people in Illinois.
Well, I agree that it's very confusing. The Tribune did a pretty good job online of putting this into a graphic format. I don't know if any of you saw that, but they show you how various the healthcare gatherings, schools, childcare, all in different, you know, listing what the phases are supposed to be for each one, and then talking about what happens to happen between the stages. It's very, a lot of moving parts. And, you know, I am pretty pessimistic about COVID-19, but even I think some of these thresholds are too strict. The one that people are talking about, I think that the state GOP is talking about, is that it requires 28 days of no overall increase in hospital admissions to go from phase two to phase three. And the national idea standard is 14 days. And so you're asking for a really significant level of control of this virus that I'm not sure we're going to get.
I predict that no plan put forward will be lived up to. And I don't care which government agency it's from. I just think first of all, this is so monumental that there's almost impossible to come up with a plan to figure out how to undo it. But the other thing is, I think they're all going to collapse sort of from the weight of themselves. I mean, I don't think, you know, this reading the governor's plan and other plans, and we could be talking about this coming into stage three or four a year from now, it seems like. I don't think that we're going to wait for that. I just don't think we are.
Steve, you were saying last week, right, that the problem is not the spread of the virus, it's the spread of the testing. The numbers are always going to go up if we keep testing people at this rate.
Sure, right. I mean, so that's why if they look at hospitalizations, that's one thing, so you know the severity of it. But if we're going to rely on the number of cases and they keep testing, you know, and my God, we keep hearing about this contact testing. Is anything like that happening? You know, and is anything like that up and running? I mean, the infrastructure of that to work that out, I just feel like I don't know when it ends.
Well, that's really the problem with this, is that these thresholds, these standards are so difficult to meet. And even once we meet them, it looks like it's quite possible to slip back.
Healthcare regions that meet certain thresholds over the next few weeks will be able to move to phase three. At that point, with face coverings as the norm, non-essential manufacturing and other non-essential businesses can open.
You could go from stage two to stage three, but then have a bad couple of weeks, and then you'd be back in stage two. I'm not exactly sure, you know, how this is going to play out because of this risk that we're all worried about of a new spike. Pritzker talks about wanting to prevent that, but I'm not sure that he can.
I mean, I think it's important to note that hospitalizations have been relatively flat for the last 2 weeks. And that, I think, means it's probably an easier standard to meet than, you know, than of declining hospitalizations for 28 days than it might appear to be. Also, the federal plan that I guess the Trump administration has dropped called for 14 days of decreasing positive tests, which is a much higher standard to meet, especially with the ramp up in testing. So, you know, I don't know that there's an easy answer to this, but I do know that the big fear is that the healthcare system is going to get overwhelmed. And if we're looking at hospitalizations, that seems like it's a more, you know, sort of a more firm metric to use when figuring out where we are in this pandemic.
Well, that's a really good point, Heather. And I think one of the things that they're talking about is that originally, and our Tribune editorial this morning made this point, which is like originally the idea is we were going to flatten this curve. And now Pritzker seems to want to be able to like beat the virus and not have it not be a threat. And that's a really tough standard to meet because this virus is going to be out there. It's going to be spread around through the population. People are going to get sick from it, but we can't, you know, if you say that if we flatten the curve and if we do have the hospital beds and so on, then I think we do have to start relaxing our standards. Otherwise,
on the other hand, there's part of me that thinks this is a really weird thing for us to be talking about because cases are still increasing. The number of cases in the Latino community in Chicago have more than doubled in the past month. And, you know, I will be the first to acknowledge my privilege. I've been home basically for 2 months. You know, I am very low risk of getting the virus. You know, I've got a husband who I send out to get food and vital supplies. Like, I'm not at risk. But if I'm somebody who works in a meatpacking plant in Little Village, the chances of me getting the virus and transmitting it to my multi-generational home is significantly greater. And I wonder if all of the political pressure that is being brought to bear on Governor Pritzker wouldn't be better put on state officials to solve those issues, because that would truly, truly bend the curve that we're talking about. And in the long run, protect all of us and perhaps set the economy up to reopen in a more robust, firm way. The horse is so far in front of the cart at this point. And I wonder if it's because most of the journalists who are covering this pandemic are people like me, at home, safe, annoyed by my kids, but otherwise not at risk.
So we have to come upon a metric that we're going to agree on. And I don't think we can agree on the number of cases, that's the vital one, because we're testing, you know, the rate of testing changes. So I do think hospitalizations is probably the way to go.
Or deaths.
But Heather was right, and Eric was right in pointing it out. When we originally did this, I get a little perturbed by, and it's not untrue, but when people, the governors start to open their state, the people in the media or others say, well, people are going to die because of your decision. Well, it may or may not be the right decision, but that's always going to be the case. And that was always going to be the case with our shutdown. It wasn't that we were going to reopen up when there was no chance of death. It was going to reopen up when we knew that it was spread out enough to where our hospitals can handle it. So when we do come out of this, yes, more people are going to die. But that was always going to be the case.
And I think to the point about like the meatpacking stuff and political pressure, the meatpacking is done through National Defense Production Act, right? Like they're being forced, they're making them go into those factories because there's massive, huge other health issues that happen if the food supply chain is broken. So there's like a weighing of consequences there. The other problem I had with Pritzker's reopening plan was the fact that he completely went it alone. And if you look at, there's a great New York Times page that lists by state where they're at in terms of their reopening progress. And it's updated all the time. And if you look at a lot of those other states' plans, they are filled with specifically names of organizations that were consulted in drafting the plan. And there are zero other organizations on Pritzker's plan, which is why it was not surprising that you see retail merchants, restaurants, and the GOP coming out against it, because clearly they weren't involved in drafting it, and their thoughts were not taken into consideration. I think that's a huge problem. You can't just go this alone. You're not going to have the best ideas coming out of the governor's office. It's just regardless of party.
Yeah, one thing that strikes me is the way this thing is broken up into four regions, and as opposed to say, you know, how many counties are there? 110?
102.
102 counties.
Spoken like a true Chicagoan.
Counties, I'd say.
There's two counties.
I was close. You have places around, you know, East St. Louis and so on that are in a different region than, I mean, the thing is that Cook County and probably the six county area here, plus around Rockford, plus around St. Louis, are going to have very different patterns of this than you're going to have in some of these counties like Vermilion County, where just there's hardly any problem. So,
you know,
why they don't do that?
I always say that if there's a surge of cases in rural Illinois, and I say that because I am a city girl, so that's basically everything south of I-80, and I will admit that bias, but they do not have the hospital capacity there. So you might have only 30 hospital rooms available for just a huge swath of rural Illinois. So if there is a surge, we are seeing more cases in more counties practically every day, if not every week, that's a bigger problem than the raw numbers might make it look. Because if you say, oh, there's only six cases in Vermilion County. Well, great. If those six cases become 32 cases, that's it. The hospital capacity is shot. And I think we need to realize that.
So I grew up in Kankakee County. So I'm
downstate.
Well, but no, I don't think it is downstate.
It's not. I'm just teasing you.
But it used to be. It used to be downstate, Heather. But I'm really surprised by the number of cases they have. So Kankakee, the city, has 244 cases. Bourbon, 68. Bradley has 27. But Manteno, the town I'm from, it's a town of 5,000 people maybe, has 21 cases. I live in Deerfield now. I don't know that Deerfield has 21 cases. And I think that is just an indication of how the metro area has stretched south into Kankakee County.
The point of the regionalization, I think it's good on, you have to take into account hospitalization and the hospital capacity. But when Pritzker was asked about a regional approach to reopening last week, he laughed at the question. And now it's like the basis of the whole plan.
Right.
I think you do have to take into account hospitalization, but that's why there's 11 regions, which he cites. There's 11 EMS regions that are so drawn as to take into account capacity, but he merged a lot of them together. So then you have parts of like McHenry County, which parts of McHenry County are like the boonies. Like it's pretty rural. And they're
parts
in the
of
same
Lake County.
Totally. And they're in the same region as downtown Chicago. Doesn't make sense.
How is Illinois doing? I mean, is it time to start looking at that compared to other states? I mean, obviously, raw numbers, New York has hit much, much harder, but they've turned the corner. They're on the way down. California seems to have turned the corner. Illinois shut down a day or two after, I think, California, pretty close. But we don't seem to have made the progress that those states have. I mean, I don't know the answer to the question. I mean, how is Illinois doing when it comes to compares to other states?
You know, so New York had an actual peak, and we can see them coming down. Illinois, you know, it ramped up and then everything shut down and it's just been this one long plateau, which I think, I don't know the explanation for that. You know, thousands of people are still dying every day. Like, this is not something that, you know, is done. And, you know, the news out of New York that there's this COVID-related symptom for kids that's basically attacking their entire immune system, you know, is terrifying for parents. So
there was a displaced kid, I think, who was in ICU out of it now, 6 years old.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's terrifying because we know so little about this new disease and how it attacks the body and who's vulnerable to it. And even though it's only about 10% of people who have severe symptoms who don't have an underlying condition, I'm not willing to take that risk. I'm just not. So, yeah,
but you're not the governor.
Yeah. I mean, even if the governor opened up everything tomorrow and said, go for it, you know, we'd stay in our house.
I still think we all struggle with perspective on this sort of thing. My producer was looking the other day at a video and it showed the exhalation of somebody when they sneeze and the distance it travels, and it goes beyond 6 feet, and it looks really awful with a black backdrop of this green fog coming out. And they were showing it over and over again on TV. And I'm like, boy, that really looks bad, but I don't think it's as bad as it looks, you know? And then let it cloud your judgment. When they had the debates for governor, did anybody ask any of the candidates, if you become governor, what would you do if there is a pandemic? Would you err on the side of the economy, or would you err on the side of healthcare?
Well, don't you think that they just would have made some mouth noises about trusting the CDC and following federal recommendations and listening?
I'll bet they would have. Yeah. I'll bet they would have. But I don't know that that's the right answer. And like, if you were a small business owner in Illinois, you'd go, great, I got the CDC guy. Donald Trump tore up the CDC. He didn't release the CDC report. I want the guy that goes, let's open up small shops and barber shops. We could be living in that state too. And I'm just suggesting that we don't know what the best course is.
This will be my, you know, 15th criticism of Pritzker in this episode. But the fact that in that press conference, he said that he didn't write the law that epidemiologists did was astonishing to me. That's an absurd statement.
Why?
You can't, because those aren't elected officials. You're the elected official and you wrote the order and you write the reopening plan, not epidemiologists. You have to own it. The buck stops with you. And if in fact those were written by epidemiologists, it would be great to know who those people are if they're determining policy in our state on a unilateral basis. And all I'm saying there is there needs to be a balance of interests. You can't just have random unelected people writing the law.
Well, honestly, I hate to side with the GOP again, but I think that they are right in calling for the legislature to figure out a way to get together and to accept its role as a co-equal branch of state government and make sure that this kind of stuff by Pritzker and his administration has the proper oversight. It is an emergency, but it's an emergency that started in March, and it is time, and there are ways for the legislature to meet. They could meet in the United Center if they had to, right? Or Wintrust Arena or someplace like that, you know, where you could have them seated every fourth chair and they could provide the kind of political oversight, because this is, at some level, Austin's right, it's a political matter. You can't just say, I'm gonna accept that expert there and that's where we're gonna go, and have cast some votes and give some more legitimacy to what the governor wants to do.
I think we should put them on boats and do like a Lake Michigan convening of the.
I was going to say they could meet along the lakeshore, because it'd be a beautiful backdrop and it's wide open.
So I would just mention that it's not just the legislators. It's not just 117 state reps and senators who meet. It's their staffs. It's the support staff. It's the custodians. It's everybody that has to clean wherever they've been. And again, I don't know the answer to this question, but having the legislature meet in person is problematic, not because a state rep might get sick, but I think that, again, you're increasing the potential rates of transmission. You're sending people from Chicago, which is by any stretch of the imagination a hotspot, into rural Illinois. And I think that has to be part of the conversation. Well, I would say the city council has been meeting not smoothly, but effectively for several weeks on Zoom. And that, I think, has got to be some sort of a solution.
How many toilets flushing would we hear if the state legislature met on Zoom?
What the FCC has said is that when the subject matter of the call ranges to the topic, then the call is transformed.
But I mean, Heather's point is well taken, except that I'm wondering if there's a way that they could at least just meet for a moment and cast the votes necessary in order that they can meet virtually.
What should they be hammering out?
They should be talking about and voting on Pritzker's emergency authority. And they should be working with him as a co-equal branch of government to figure out what needs to be done. I mean, like I said, it was an emergency. It remains an emergency, but you can't just say, well, we have an emergency forever, and the governor gets unilaterally to make all these decisions forever. Right?
And the first order of business is allow Zoom meetings. That's all you have to vote on.
Absolutely.
You would solve the whole problem.
Absolutely.
And you might not need to have all the staff and the janitors show up. You could have them show up a few at a time, drive into the chamber, vote, get the car, and leave. I don't know. I mean, it seems like there's got to be a way to do this.
Particularly since the people are getting restless. It's still been cool in Chicago. And as the weather gets warmer and the people either miss paychecks or their unemployment doesn't cover what they need, there's going to be pitchforks. Businesses are just going to go rogue and open up.
Well, one thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit today, again, we talked about masks last week, but since then there was a story in the Associated Press that I think maybe first appeared on Rich Miller's blog, but it had to do with the number of stores where there were confrontations between employees and customers who were refusing to wear a mask. Some of them were explicitly saying that not wearing a mask was a political statement, which is to say that wearing a mask is a political statement. And so we're in this position right now where the one thing that would really make it easier to open things up would be if people were to abide by these kind of recommendations. But because I think because of the president's lack of leadership on this, not wearing a mask is seen as being a warrior against COVID-19. And that's only going to delay matters.
Well, we had the security guard shot in Michigan. There were two employees at a McDonald's. I forget where the state was there, Oklahoma maybe. And they were shot over because the seating indoors was closed. So people's tempers are sort of waning. I have my mask around my neck all the time, and I pull it up when I come upon someone. But I don't really think, I'm not convinced that having a mask is is helpful. That case just hasn't been made to me.
I mean, yeah, but that's beside the point, Steve. I mean,
I'm happy to send you all of the science.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's like Dr. Bertrand.
No, I know.
It doesn't even matter. The legal authority is the governor's, regardless of how effective it is, right? I mean, it's the same way you can say you can't come into a store without shoes. They can say you have to have a mask to enter the store. It's
sure,
the
no, and I'm happy to abide by that. Don't misunderstand me. I am happy to follow the rules. But my point is, the questions about the mask came before the requirements for the masks. So it wasn't like we had Dr. Fauci or Governor Pritzker saying, and by the way, I want you all to wear masks because that helps. It was reporters and others saying, hey, should we wear masks? Should we wear masks? And they didn't even say yes right away. Eventually, they said, yes, you should wear a mask. I mean, so if I can't believe I'm arguing this case. If this is such a clear-cut benefit, why, when we locked the state down, did we not have a wear your mask order? We didn't have one until reporters started asking people about it.
It did evolve. You're exactly right. In fact, I think the Surgeon General, maybe it was in early March, was telling people not to wear masks.
Right.
I think it's two different things. One, there was a shortage of masks, and there was clear lack of or worry, at least on the governor's part and the mayor's part, to make an order that people couldn't abide by. So that's why you've got the mayor out there distributing 1,000 or 1,000,000 masks and handing, you know, and you've got Willie Wilson, who's basically going to war with Lightfoot over this. A, the science evolved, and B, there was a real fear among the governor and the mayor's staff that if they issued this order, you would have police departments arresting huge numbers of Black and Brown Chicagoans, you know, sort of, or detaining them at least for not wearing a mask. And then you've got a public safety crisis on your hand when you've got Cook County Jail being a huge hotspot. You know, you hear conservatives, and that's you, Austin, talking about how you don't want to see unfunded mandates. This is a huge unfunded mandate, right?
So I'm 100% in favor of masks, and I think there probably should be, especially for reopening stores, there should be a mask requirement, and reopening factories and things of that nature. I don't think the science has had to evolve that much. Like in many Asian countries, they've figured out masks work a long time ago, and they're very prevalent and part of society. And that's for good reason. Even if there was uncertainty around the science, you want to use them as a precautionary measure. Now, the problem I have, though, I think that is they're not being upfront. What you just said, Heather, about the fact that they weren't doing mask requirements because they were afraid they couldn't get masks for first responders and healthcare workers. They don't say that. We have to infer that.
Lightfoot said that explicitly.
When? Well, I don't think she said that out when we had a peak.
Weeks ago, we said, why aren't you making an order for masks?
And it was because healthcare work? Okay. So yeah, I stand corrected on that. I don't think that's a good reason.
I mean, she didn't think it was a good reason either, but she was saying, look, I'm not dealing with what's up here. I'm dealing with what's down here.
And people shouldn't be, you know, like, having the mask Stasi going through and arresting people would be horrible. And that would be really bad. But I will say that I have a big problem with the conservative, I wouldn't describe myself as conservative, but the conservative double standard that businesses have a right to do what they wish. And if a business decides that all the people going in need to wear masks, as John said, like no shirt, no shoes rule, that should be completely up to their discretion, and people should absolutely obey that if they want to go in that store. If they don't, go to a different store.
Dr. Sanjay Gupta, the guy on CNN, I think has been very good and very clear through all of this. And he talks about the fact that he goes out jogging, and when he jogs and runs by people, he does not wear a mask because he doesn't think that the danger is such that he should give up jogging or try to breathe through a mask of contamination. So, and he advocates masks, don't get me wrong. But I just think the value of these masks is inflated.
It's a calculation, but Austin, are you safe?
Can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
I'm sorry, but I'm walking across the the Columbus Avenue Bridge this morning coming to work. I'm on the sidewalk. This is Columbus. Now, there's not a lot of traffic, but still. I'm on the sidewalk wearing a mask. There's another woman coming toward me wearing a mask. And what did she do? Rather than share the 5-foot wide sidewalk, she walked into the lane of traffic to walk away from me to avoid getting the virus. What was greater What was greater that I was, and then the traffic was coming from behind her. Did she face a greater threat from me in my mask or from stepping into Columbus Avenue?
You'd never do something like that?
I walked to the side of the sidewalk, but I wouldn't walk into traffic. No, I wouldn't walk into traffic. Honest to God, John, I don't think you and I walking by each other pose a threat to each other. I mean, they
I know that, but I mean, so why judge her cautionary style? Like, if that makes her feel good and she doesn't get hit by a bus.
Well, I guess I'm not judging it. And when I saw it, I thought, wow, she must be really worried.
She is. No,
I think the danger of two people walking beside each other, it's pretty slight. I mean, they talk about prolonged access with people. You're shaking your head at me, but go, and Heather, maybe you have more of the science of it. But what people talk about when they spread this disease, they talk about prolonged contact between two people.
Yeah, but one thing is,
it's not two people passing on a sidewalk.
Yeah, it's one thing that's really interesting to me and puzzling and maddening and everything else is that we really don't know how this disease is transmitted. We don't know the way it is and way it isn't transmitted. And there seems to be something about touching surfaces. What I've heard, what Steve has heard, which is that you have to be in prolonged association with people to get it, but that can't be right because people are picking it up from these people who are delivering food or checking people out of stores are picking it up, and that's not prolonged contact. We don't know the means of transmission. We know that it's highly contagious, and I have this. I've heard the same thing you have, Steve, that it takes more than just passing somebody on the sidewalk.
If I passed you on the sidewalk and sneezed, then yeah.
But who's doing that? I mean, are people sneezing
or coughing? No, I agree. But I mean, I think that's the risk. I just think two people passing in on a sidewalk, I don't feel. And listen, I give you guys free liberty because if I come down with this virus and am very sick or die, please, on the next one, the next Mincing Rascals after.
Dear God, Steve.
You can point out that I was completely wrong about this.
That'll take some of the sting out of it for us.
It'll be good content.
To be able to say, right. I told you so. It always makes people feel better. So.
Were you saying, though, Austin, was your point that business owners should be able to determine whether or not a face mask is required? That should be up to individual shops?
I was more speaking in the abstract of, like, in Michigan, where I do think some stores have said it's a mask. There's a mask requirement in the store, although there might not necessarily be one via state order. Like, if a business decides it wants to do that, there should be nothing preventing them from doing that. I'm glad Lightfoot was honest about that because I didn't know that she had said that. And so I'm glad Heather was here to tell us that she was saying that. But I saw more global leaders. Other countries right now are looking at us so askance at this idea that we should have. We're in complete lockdown, some states, but there isn't a mask requirement. Like, that seems backwards in terms of the global response. And I think, Steve, you mentioned that. That's a really weird dichotomy. The mask stuff works. It can be a face covering. It doesn't have to be an N95 or a World War II gas mask. It can make a difference, especially and that the difference it makes, just like the spread of the virus, is like an exponential difference because it's about preventing spread.
Well, I totally agree with your contention, Austin, that you don't want people, or maybe as Heather said this also, you don't want people arrested for not wearing a mask in a store. You don't want to see these violent confrontations, people, you know, shoving each other in stores. That's bad for health as well as safety in general. But what you do want is you want it to become a norm. And one of the things that I'm thinking of is like smoking. It's against the law to smoke in a restaurant. You don't see anybody arrested for that anymore because it is just normative now. I don't think you can walk into Walgreens smoking a cigarette. I don't think you can go to most places and just, you know, smoking indoors. It just isn't done anymore. That's because we have established these norms. No, I don't think anybody's been arrested for that in a long time. But when you don't have the leadership at the top, and I go back to Trump not wearing a mask the other day when he's touring a mask-making factory, and the sign at the entrance says, wear your mask at all times, and he is too macho to wear a mask. And that message is filtering down throughout a huge percentage of the population.
You know, another, you talk about smoking and not smoking in restaurants being the norm. Someone earlier referenced the no shoes, no shirt, no service sign, which is very funny if you think of it now, because those signs in the 70s used to be needed because we used to walk into fast food restaurants sometimes barefoot or often without a shirt on. I mean, I'm old enough to know, but remember when we used to do that. And then that became unacceptable. And that's when those signs came up.
That's exactly right. It traces back to the 70s. And it was basically the stuff I read about that is that it was aimed at, you know, hippies, quote unquote hippies. So that's where those signs come from.
Eric, is it the leadership problem with the president not wearing the mask? He said that he's tested and he's not positive. That is, he's positive, he's not positive. Even though one of his aides now evidently has COVID-19, but he's constantly tested so he can tour the mask making factory and break the rules safely because he's not going to give it to anybody. I guess it still makes him vulnerable, though. He could still get it and pass it along unknowingly in some sort of time frame. I really think the reason he's not wearing it, it's not just vanity, but it looks weak. It looks frightened. If your leader is wearing a mask, didn't you all think that at first? Like the first time you saw J.B. Pritzker walk out with one, you go, holy crap, this thing is real. And I think it just projects a message of vulnerability that he doesn't want to convey.
It is real and he is vulnerable. We're all vulnerable. That's a message that needs to get out there. And again, if people were all to sort of get behind that and say, we're all taking this seriously, I would be a lot more sympathetic to the people who are saying, God, let me open my hair salon. Let me go bowling. If I felt that they were taking it seriously and they were showing me they're taking it seriously. I mean, not wearing a mask is a selfish act. Right, because you can infect somebody, and you can be carrying any one of us at this virtual table that could be carrying this virus. We could infect somebody because there are a number of people who are asymptomatic. So, not wearing a mask, increasing the risk that you'll transmit it, is a selfish act. I haven't been tested. I don't think you've been tested. I have felt no reason to be tested. But you know, you could be tested and I think Kaylee said this from the rostrum that you can be tested and then 5 minutes later you can, you know, touch a door handle and you could be carrying the virus.
Yeah, but you could get tested for the antibody now. That's the one I want. I think I am going to go do that. Cost me $100 or something like that, but I'm going to see if I can get tested for the antibody because I would love that. That would feel like a get out of jail card to me. Even though Heather, I know it's not. False confidence, maybe, but I think a measure of protection.
Well, I also think another issue is that those tests have been proven to be really, really inaccurate because the FDA waived the rule that says you've got to show that your test is accurate before it can go to market. They said, go ahead, go to market, and we'll figure it out later. And now we're figuring it out later. And so many of those tests are showing either false positives or false negatives. I'm not a doctor, but I will play one on this podcast, and I will suggest that you not rely on any of those results to make health-defying decisions.
I'm talking with a friend in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they've had cars driving around the neighborhood that usually say, like, when street cleaning is and, like, get your car out of the parking lot or whatever. But now they're saying it's a mask requirement. It's a $300 fine in Cambridge, Massachusetts, if you are out in public without a mask. I think that is overkill. I don't think it's you don't really need to have a mask if you're just running or jogging in a non-crowded area. It's overkill.
Did you guys see the thing about Axl Rose and Steve Mnuchin on Twitter? Esquire just posted this. Whatever anyone may have previously thought of Steve Mnuchin, he's officially an a-hole, Rose tweeted on Wednesday about President Donald Trump's Treasury Secretary. Rose appeared to be responding to Mnuchin's baffling interview on Fox Business Network Monday, in which he said, quote,
"This is a great time for people to explore America. A lot of people haven't seen many parts of America. I wish I could get back on the road soon. So we're looking to all get back to business."
Mnuchin responded to Rose with, "What have you done for the country lately?" And at the end of the tweet, he accidentally, apparently, included an emoji of the Liberian flag, which seemingly mistook for the American flag. Do not get into Twitter wars. Don't. Everybody in the administration should put down their phones and stop tweeting. You never win, even when you're right.
When I think of safety and, you know, like rational responses to health, the first name that comes to mind, Axl Rose.
Policy. You know, that's just the last point I'll close with. And that is, I do think, though, that in Illinois, we're sort of saying, let's cede policy to the doctors. We're very conservative about it. And then there's Donald Trump on the other hand that would love to forget all of that. He told a nurse off the other day when She was standing right there in the White House on National Nurses Day.
The infection control measures that we learned back when we went to school, one gown, one mask for one patient a day or per time, this is a different time. And I've been reusing my N95 mask for a few weeks now. I just broke out a new one to come here just in case I needed to wear it. So PPE has been sporadic, but it's been manageable.
Sporadic for you, but not sporadic for a lot of other people.
Oh, no, I agree, Mr. President.
Because absolutely. I've heard the opposite. I've heard that they are loaded up.
The face he made was classic. Eric, what's your take on Joe Biden finally at least responding on Morning Joe to the Tara Reid allegations?
I thought he did pretty well. That was last Friday morning, and Mika Brzezinski gave him a pretty good grilling. I think most people would say that even though it was MSNBC and that show has been really tough on Trump, she made him sit there for 18 minutes and answer the questions about Tara Reid, asked every which way. And I mean, and his answers were, he just did a flat out denial.
I don't remember any type of complaint she may have made. It was 27 years ago. And I don't remember, nor does anyone else that I'm aware of. And the fact is that I don't remember. I don't remember any complaint ever having been made.
I don't know what else exactly he could have said that would make this go away. I don't think anything's going to make this go away, really. We're going to be talking about it all year, and people are going to be analyzing her story and complaining about the Kavanaugh hearings. And I did a column earlier this week talking about the rape allegations against Trump that haven't really been aired very much, the E. Jean Carroll's accusation that he raped her in the mid-90s. So.
Do you believe her, Eric?
Who?
Tara Reid.
I really don't know. I really don't know. It's hard to say. I haven't studied the case carefully enough. I'm sort of dreading going through all the little facts. Do you believe her?
I don't even like the question.
You're willing to ask it.
No, but I mean, it is such an unfair question in a way because we don't know. And it boils down to a he said, she said. And my default these days is I believe the woman. I believe in the case of Clarence Thomas, in the case of Kavanaugh, in the case of Bill Clinton, in the case of Donald Trump, I believe the women in all of those cases. So that doesn't mean she's telling the truth, but I believe the woman. That's where I'm starting here. And I think his standing there just resolutely denying it isn't all that compelling. I mean, that's what a liar would do too, I think.
I have significant questions about her story. I think that the fact that the first time she spoke to the news media, she said that he merely sort of, you know, made her uncomfortable in the way that he touched her, and then sort of said, well, it was actually this. And, you know, I, as a journalist, tend to judge people with the outlets that they chose. And she chose a very pro Bernie Sanders outlet. And there are tweets between her and the reporter saying, I can't wait for this to come out and take down Biden. That, as a reporter, makes me skeptical of anybody's story. I don't know if you guys seen her weird tweets about Putin and what a sexy, strong man he is. And that also makes my spidey sense tingle, but it doesn't make me feel good. It gives me a terrible, you know, pit in my the bottom of my stomach. But I have a lot of questions about the story in a way that I did not have about the questions that Christine Blasey Ford brought up about Justice Kavanaugh. That's where I am.
Is there something to be said for the fact that there probably exists some records if there was a complaint made at the time?
But now she made a complaint, but she chickened out and did not allege sexual assault, only alleged sexual harassment. So she says, well, even if you find that complaint, I didn't actually say what happened, which, again, as a reporter.
But haven't we learned by now that sexual assault and women reporting it is really a different animal, that they don't respond the way they would if I stole your car or ripped off your bank account or some other crime?
Absolutely. But if you say I made a complaint and it says X, and then you say, well, actually, I didn't say X. I chickened out. I think, you know, if there was any sort of allegation, that would tingle my spidey sense.
Yeah, if it was a sexual harassment allegation, I would like to see the records of that.
Guess who's in charge of that? Oh, yeah. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who says he will not release those reports.
Interesting. And that's where are those held again?
In the Senate's archives.
In the Senate archives. Okay.
I've gotten a lot. I wrote about the allegation against Trump, the Eugene Carroll allegation, and said that if we're going to talk about Tara Reid, we need to talk about Eugene Carroll and the other allegations against Trump. And I heard from a whole bunch of people saying, you've got the actual analogy here to look at is Tara Reid versus Christine Blasey Ford, and which one of them, and the way the left wing media treated Christine Blasey Ford versus how they're treating Tara Reid, and that is on its face, it's a fair question because none of these cases are identical or even necessarily analogous, but you're going to have to engage that question, the question that Heather brought up about. You know, that Christine Blasey Ford's story never changed, really, and Tara Reid's did. And then, of course, the reason that everyone was so head up about the Kavanaugh allegation was that it was urgent. I mean, it was happening right before they were going to vote on his nomination for a lifetime appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's May. The election is not until November. Is the urgency here to try to get the Democrats to dump Joe Biden? Is that but that convention isn't even until August, so there isn't the urgency to dig into every last little detail of this right now. And there really was with Kavanaugh.
Well, I would argue that the call and the urgency in the Christine Blasey Ford case was for the FBI to investigate the allegations, not to sort of make a determination one way or the other. And it's clear in retrospect that the FBI never truly investigated the allegations. So, you know, I don't think that you would find a Democrat or a feminist saying, don't investigate Tara Reid's claims, don't give her a fair hearing. I think it's a fundamentally different question to whether you say, you know, is this accurate or should it be investigated? Those are two very different standards, I think.
Who should investigate in your guys' view? That was what I was confused because there was talk that the DNC may investigate, and then people were up in arms like, well, how the heck is the DNC going to conduct a fair investigation?
There hasn't been a ton of polling on this, but I did see a poll that showed that a majority of Democrats believe Tara Reid and that those Democrats were 90% going to vote for Joe Biden, and that they essentially said, you know what, I believe something happened. You know, I'm not 100% sure what happened, but it doesn't change anything.
Of course, the other point is that let's say you do believe her completely, you also have to say, well, this compares to something like 24 allegations of sexual harassment and abuse against Trump. So if you're looking for someone who doesn't do that, then you're going to have to vote for Justin Amash or some third party candidate, because you're not the two main party candidates, the two plausible presidents are both implicated in this kind of thing. So it becomes a wash then, and you move on to other things like.
But does that work that way to you, Eric? Do you think that because Trump got away with it, then Biden gets away with it too?
Politically, I think that's true. Yeah, I think. I mean, anybody who votes on that issue will have to say, well, you know, I'm going to have to look to other issues here because both of them are implicated in this. Now, I happen to think that Trump is far more implicated than Biden, but I think it does pretty much wash out.
This is such a sad calculation, isn't it? I mean, I pointed to two Supreme Court justices, two of the last three presidents, and the guy who may be president. And guarantee if Biden's guilty of something here, then the next president, all sexual assaulters. I mean, that's... It's mind-boggling.
Makes you wonder about the men in general who are in charge of our lives, doesn't it?
Hey, I know everybody who's listening to this podcast will already know this, but I was just following the Twitter feeds. It looks like there were 138 new deaths, COVID-19. Yeah, in Illinois. And so that number has been up high. It's been up in the 130s and 140s for the last 3 days. That number has not been coming down in the least, and I keep hoping that it's going to come down. And I'm every time I see that new number, it's like,
why do we keep hearing about the flattening of the curve here? Every time I look at those charts, that thing seems just getting higher and higher. Maybe the rate of growth is not
correct. That's it. Yeah.
But I mean, that is a very modest accommodation for me.
So a month ago, cases were doubling every 2 days in Chicago. Now cases are doubling every 15 to 16 days. However, cases are still rising. So it's good news, but it's not great news.
Yeah. Oh, I want it to be less, not
everybody
at a lower rate. Eric, I know that you wanted to talk about football.
Oh, no, I was just thinking about some of the things that are coming up. The Pitchfork was canceled, and it looks like Lollapalooza is going to be canceled. Almost has to be any day now. And they're talking quite a bit about the Big Ten can't get its schools to agree they're even going to open in the fall. So if they don't open, the NCAA and most of the schools are saying we can't really have football. And that's a big, big deal in terms of what it means to our culture, and what it means to, you know, just students not going back to college and where they're going to go and what a lot of these smaller institutions are going to do to keep themselves afloat. My son just graduated this weekend. He's going to graduate from a small college in West Virginia. And I don't know how that school is going to. Thank you. I don't know how that school is going to do. My daughter's going to graduate from IIT later this month, and I don't know how they're going to do in terms of all this. It's very difficult. A lot of these smaller schools rely on foreign students who aren't going to want to be traveling here. That was all involved in my football topic.
No, I get it, and I'm really sorry. Just on a personal level for your family, I'm sure you'd like to celebrate those accomplishments more, and then. Yeah, how hard that is for these other schools going forward. I'm just going to make one prediction here. I've moved the 4th of July to July 15th for Major League Baseball returns. That's in empty stadiums, July 15th, MLB games will be played. Then, by the way, that's my optimistic prediction. Give me a good news prediction there, Austin Berg. You tell me something.
July 15th would be awesome. That's my birthday. Happy birthday to my dad, whose birthday is today. I'll take the 15th. That's really optimistic.
How about you, Eric? You got one for us?
An optimistic prediction?
Yeah.
No, I don't. Sorry.
All right, Heather, you wrap it up.
I am optimistic that schools will start in person in the fall.
Really?
As good as I can do.
No, we'll take that too. You guys, it's good to hear your voices and see your faces. By the way, in the backdrop of Eric Zorn's Zoom picture, it's a display of ribeye and looks like New York strip steaks. Lots of steaks. Eric's in a sea of steaks today.
It's all about meat. My column tomorrow is about President Trump's order to reopen meat factories and in the name of national defense.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Austin. Thanks, Heather.
See you guys.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.